Writers Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and our guest today is Leo Daughtry. And Leo is the author of Talmadge Farm. He's a lifelong resident of North Carolina, grew up among the tobacco fields of Sampson County, which served as inspiration for his debut novel, which is Talmadge Farm. After graduating from Wake Forest University and its School of Law, he established a private law practice in Smithfield, North Carolina, was a member of the North Carolina House and Senate for 28 years, including serving as House Majority Leader and House Minority Leader. When not practicing law, Leo enjoys spending time in Atlantic Beach with his wife and daughters. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Leo.
Thank you so much, Monica, for having me. Thank you.
Great. So tell us, Leo, after a career in law and politics, what drew you to write a novel?
Well, I wanted to let people know about how farming was in the 50s, early 60s. Most people, you know, were like born after the war was over. And I was born before the war started. And so I lived at a time when all the farms in my area were farmed by what we call sharecroppers. And they came out of the black sharecroppers came out of the Civil War in that way. And the white sharecroppers came from the Depression, where they lost almost everything and had to work for the landowner. So these people were everywhere in the 50s and early 60s. I wanted to tell their story about how their life was very poor, both black and white, and how it ended, how sharecropping finally ended in this area and was replaced by what we call migrant workers, workers who came down from Florida up the coast, stopping in South Carolina, and then migrating up to North Carolina, then on to Virginia and up that way.
And of course, the migrant workers didn't have it any better than the sharecroppers.
No, it was a terrible time.
Wow. So were most of the farms there at that time when, like, this book is set in the late 50s, early 60s? Were most of the farms tobacco farms?
In this area, yes.
Yeah.
This was the tobacco. It was a contradiction. It literally made our state. For example, we had Duke University, which prospered because of tobacco. We have Wake Forest University, prospered because of tobacco. All the small towns were using tobacco as a way for their economy to sustain itself. That was good. But what at the same time, tobacco was killing people. So it was a contradiction, and as time went by, people began to realize more and more that perhaps smoking wasn't as good for you, even though it really helped the economy. It wasn't the best thing in the world to do. So things were changing in the late 50s and early 60s, both how farming was done, how it's becoming to be mechanized, and how people were listening to the Surgeon General and others talking about what's going to happen to our economy. That's when we had diversity. We started having things like the Research Triangle Park, which was taking the universities. We had University of North Carolina, NC State, and Duke, and building all of these very modern businesses around it. The first one was IBM that came. So we began to see our state diversifying and tobacco losing its dominance in our economy.
And in Talmadge Farm, the kind of the beginnings of that research triangle are kind of a plot point in this book,
yeah,
too. Yeah.
Our governor was trying to find a way to diversify our economy, not rely on tobacco completely. So he had this idea of a research triangle park right in the midst of these universities. And he went to New York and convinced over a period of time, IBM to move first, and now it is a very good area for economic growth.
It certainly worked out, and that came from government in the first in the it was
yes,
backed by government. That's really interesting.
Was the one who created, he didn't create it, but he got the IBM to come.
Wow. So I have got to tell you something. My grandfather was a banker in southeastern Pennsylvania, and they owned a tobacco farm in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. So when I was a child, they were still farming tobacco on the land there. They don't anymore, and I don't know when it stopped exactly. But they had the big tobacco barns where they would hang the tobacco leaves across these long wooden things, and they hang down and they dry them up at the top of the barn. And as kids, we would go and play in that barn and climb up to the very top. And it was high. You know, it was really, if we had fallen, we would have died, I'm sure. But because you'd climb, there were these ladders that were like built in to, the barn was built into the side of a hill. And the tractors would drive in from the top of the hill to where they would hang the, so there was a floor in the middle. But on both sides, the barn was open clear down to the haymow. And so those side walls that were sort of in the middle had these built-in ladders that you'd climb up, and then you'd walk across a railing, and then you'd climb up another ladder that was open on both sides, and you'd walk across another rail and get clear up to the top. 8 years old, we were doing that, 8, 9 years old. And it's like, it's crazy the things that we did. And then you'd jump down into the hay, and not from clear at the top, because we wouldn't have survived that. We were smart enough to know you don't jump that far. So I have a lot of memories of tobacco. Now I'm pretty sure the fields were farmed by the Amish neighbors. So it wasn't a sharecropping, or it might have been sharecropping, but they weren't in poverty. And
no, the difference is they would cut the entire tobacco stalk,
right,
hang it and dry cure it. And then in the South, we would take the leaves off. And we would take the leaves off in time and on a stick and hang them up in the barn. So it was a different process. And our tobacco situation was much more labor intensive.
Wow. So did you grew up around these tobacco farms too?
I did.
You climb in the tobacco barns too?
I did. Just like you.
Yep. So, it was, when I started reading this, it's like, I know what he's talking about here.
It's great. It is a coincidence for sure.
Yeah. Yep. So tell me a little bit about the Talmadges and, the inspiration for these characters.
Well, it's a population of a number of people. The Talmadges were big landowners. They had been there all their life. Their ancestors had compiled about 1,800 acres of land in one tract on the Neuse River. It was beautiful farmland. They had the finest house that was built by Proctor Talmadge some years before, so probably in the late 1800s or early 1900s. It was an absolute showplace. And they loved that style. They loved the way their life was. They didn't want it to change. So they had sharecroppers. And they also had a bank. And the bank was not changing also. It was only lending money to farmers. So the time came when they should have started doing other things like credit cards, loaning money on cars. So they were not keeping up either. So you can see the Talmadge family begin to not accept the changes that were taking place, and they were suffering because of it.
Well, I would say, based on the book, maybe the men in the Talmadge family liked their lives the way they were.
Well, it was a time when women, there was no pill. So women were, they did not get divorced. That was just out of the question. And they lived sort of as women did in those days, as subservient to the men. They didn't work. They either taught school or stayed home. There was no jobs that women could fulfill at that time. And so they were more or less second-class citizens. And I wanted to make the women in my book the really good, strong people and survive. And that's what I was hoping to do with the book, is show how women had to change and how they really did a good job looking after their family in spite of all things.
I think you did. Yes, the women characters I feel in this book are extremely well written, I think. And I never had this feeling, 'cause you really do spend part of your time inside the heads of some of the women characters.
Yes.
Some of it's from the point of view of Gordon, kind of the patriarch of the family, but also Claire, his wife, and Ivy, the cook,
Cook.
and her daughter,
Every
and
landowner had a cook
yeah,
on the sharecropper.
and then Mary Grace, the daughter of the white sharecropper. And so I never felt, because sometimes, honestly, when you, as a woman, reading books written by men where it's from the point of view of a woman, I'm like, they don't really get it, but I feel like you did. I never felt like it was that it, that I didn't see any, I didn't feel any wrong notes in how you wrote those women.
I wanted to make them as strong as possible and more easily adaptable than the men.
So, and not, of course, not all the men really bought into the way things were either. The younger son, as an example,
David.
David did not, he didn't want to follow in his father's footsteps. And he didn't like the way women and people of color were treated in that South. And do you think there were white men of privilege who stood up for the less privileged people during that time?
Not many.
Yeah.
It was a complete segregation. We had separate schools, separate bathrooms. That it was total segregation. And so the only time that the races mixed any were the sharecroppers. They had to exchange. They didn't have any money, so they would swap work. One sharecropper would help the other sharecropper to do their work, so because they didn't have to pay them. And one of the things that a landowner wanted was a sharecropper with lots of children. That means that he'd have lots of people working on the farm. It was a way of life that was, it went on from the 30s to the late 50s and early 60s.
So, what was, who were you in that time period?
Well, my father had land, so we had sharecropping, and I knew them all. A black family named Bennett was on the farm where I lived, and they had four boys. One was my age, and the other three were older. And they were my playmates and my friends. And I was 7, 8, 9 years old. I didn't know. They were the ones I saw every day. So we became friends and we played baseball a little. But I would get up and go get on the school bus, and then their house was maybe 100 yards, and their school bus would pick them up. So we would just say hello and goodbye for schools. It was a different time, just a completely different time. And I wanted to tell that story.
Do you feel like the people there? I mean, I think it's important to tell that story for people who didn't live there, who don't maybe realize what it was actually like. But the people who lived through it, or the people who, younger people who are there, do you think they know or remember what it was like?
No, I don't think so. They're too young.
Yeah.
But they may have their parents or their grandparents talking about how it was when they were young. The sharecroppers, very few had electricity. Very few had bathrooms. It was just a cabin.
Well, you know, my mother was born and raised in Iowa, and her, which is where I am right now, her sweetheart, it was a high school sweetheart that she reconnected with after both had lost their spouses 50 years later, and he was living in Raleigh, Durham area, but he's from Iowa, and he had told me that he felt like the South never finished fighting the Civil War, that there were still people down there who would want to go back to these times.
Yeah.
Do you agree with that?
I think it's less now, but there's always been, you know, like in fraternities, there was a fraternity Kappa Alpha that was a Southern fraternity, and their leader was Robert E. Lee, and they had lots of statues in every town that had a Confederate general. I have one of those in my book. There was many instances of whites wanting to be like they were, like their ancestors were. There was the Ku Klux Klan, there were plenty of those members around. And so it took a long time, and the South is still recovering, but I think we have almost recovered.
Hmm. I guess what I'd like to know is, like, at what point did you come to realize that system of sharecropping was wrong and was not something that you'd want to continue with?
It didn't dawn on me really until I began to see that the mechanization was coming along and these big farms were getting much larger. They were consolidating, and they were becoming sort of a big business. Before they were like sharecroppers, were small, who had only a few acres. But now things were changing. The way they harvested tobacco changed. They had different kinds of barns. They had mechanized ways to plant the plants. And so they just pushed the sharecroppers out. They had nowhere to go. But the sharecroppers did not want their children to be sharecroppers when they grew up. They wanted them to be off the farm where they'd have a chance to, you know, have a good life.
Right, right. And one of the paths in the book was through the military?
Oh, yes. We live in an area near Fayetteville, which is the home of Fort Bragg. It's had a different name now, but the blacks, some would go up north trying to find a job, say in New Jersey or Philadelphia or places like that. But a lot of them didn't know how to get up there. So they realized that they could join the Army. And the 82nd Airborne was headquartered in Fayetteville. So they all joined the Army and volunteered to get into the 82nd Airborne, thinking they could go to Fayetteville and be close to home, but have a good life. But what happened, all those kids who went into the late 50s and early 60s, who went into the Army, had to go to Vietnam, and a lot of them were killed, a lot of them, or wounded terribly.
Wow. Now, your book has been described as a love letter to the American South. Why is that?
Because I think that in spite of what the South has done and is doing, and everybody loves the South. The South has a charm about it. And this book talks about the good parts of the South and how good the people are and what the South has meant to so many of us, and it's that you love. It's a love story in many respects.
But you're also, but you're not shying away from the problems either.
No, I think facing the problems is important wherever you live.
Yeah. I mean, what do you think about the fact that there may be some places in the United States where your book might be banned because it's talking about a history that people don't want others to learn about?
Oh, no, that would be a mistake. It's just a true story. I mean, it's not a true story, but it has some historical.
Right, right.
And I wouldn't want anybody to think that the book is telling something that's not true or telling something that didn't happen. Because it all happened.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, one of the things that happens in the book is the Surgeon General's report on the dangers of smoking comes out. So you were around when that happened.
Sure was.
Tell us a little bit about the impact of that on the farmers and on the economy and on people.
At the time, I think about half of the United States adults smoked, around half. And in every movie you saw John Wayne or Gary Cooper or all of them smoking, it was very romantic. They would smoke and talk to the girl. Cigarettes, I mean, you just wanted to smoke. I wanted to smoke when I was 12, and I did, because I thought it was a cool thing to do. And so the cigarette manufacturers realized that they could take cigarettes and make them something that was glamorous and that you wanted to do. And then Marlboro made it look like a man with a tattoo was smoking and he was a big deal. And so it just took off. And then the Surgeon General came along and said, and I'd be good for it. But it didn't change much at that time. It was like over a period of time, people began to say, I don't think smoking is good for you. I know that the athletes, after the Surgeon General came out with his recommendation about smoking, many of them would not smoke, or the coach wouldn't let them smoke, because it took some of their stamina.
So even before the Surgeon General said that, people knew.
Yeah, they suspected that if you smoke, it's going to do harm to your lungs. And if you're an athlete, you got to have plenty of breathing so you can go a long distance.
Right, right. So did you quit smoking?
I did. It was a hard thing to do.
Yeah, it's interesting to me, like my mother recently had a medical incident and I was with her, with the doctor, and the doctor says, so I see you are a previous smoker. And I'm like, well, she hasn't smoked in 50 years, but it's still on her medical record. And it's like, I wouldn't have thought, I mean, I knew when I was young that my mother occasionally smoked when I was a little kid, but then I knew she quit. And never a big deal made about it. But it's interesting because for my generation, very few of my friends ever took up smoking. It just, and this would have been in the 70s. So by that time,
when I was coming along, everybody smoked. Girls started smoking, it was just the thing to do.
Yeah. And you're more like my mother's age, probably. And so, so it was like surprising to me how many people back then did smoke.
That's true.
Yeah. And it almost makes you wonder the ones who didn't, why they didn't.
that's a good question.
Yeah. So, when you decided to write this book, tell me, did you have the characters first? Describe how the story came to you?
I had the beginning, and I had the end, and I had the characters. I knew who I wanted. I wanted to have a white sharecropping family and a black sharecropping family. I wanted to have the landowner, and I wanted to have his demise at the end and him go through all of the turmoil that the changes were taking place. And it was just sort of, I knew what I wanted to do. And so I spent a lot of time making an outline. And then I would take that outline and change it and kill off somebody or add somebody. But when I got the outline, I had everybody I wanted in there. So we would write a chapter and then go to the next chapter. It just took a long time.
So you had a complete outline before you started actually writing the chapters.
Yeah, but as you know, Monica, when you write, you start and you get on another trail that you didn't plan on. And then you got to figure out where you're going to go with that. And so either you turn around or you have to make changes. It's writing a chapter can take you on a rabbit hunt that you won't expect. But anyway, I would bring it back, and I did have an outline of basically what I wanted to do, what I wanted to write. I had taken Jake to Philadelphia to the farmer's market because I had done that as a boy. I had ridden with a man who recapped tires, and he went there to take produce, and he'd get there at 5 a.m. and unload his produce, and then get to Brooklyn, New York by before lunch. And he would sleep for a few hours and then come back home with a load of tires. So I knew about the trip. And I had gone, and I was 15 when I went. I was 1955. So I wanted to put that in the book because it actually happened to me. And recapping tires, everybody had recapped tires when I was a boy.
Interesting. And like in the book, it says that up north, they just get new tires instead of recapping them. And so, but down south, they keep recapping
particularly the taxis. The taxis did not want to have flat tires. And so they would run their tires until there was a little bit of thread left, but not much. And so he would go buy those tires for $1. Bring them back to where I lived, and he had a recapping place, and he would recap them and sell them for $12, $10.
So does anybody recap tires today?
No, not that I know of.
Wow. Think of all the waste. But anyway, you're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Leo Daughtry, author of Talmadge Farm. Leo, why don't you read a little bit from the book for us?
Gladly. I'm going to read a little bit about the Black family, the African-American sharecroppers. They had a cabin, and this is chapter 2. Slivers of sunlight shimmered through the chinks in the pine boards that made up the walls of the cabin. Ivy Sanders was already awake, enjoying the tranquility of the morning. Sundays were her glory days when she felt the chains of obligation loosen. On Sundays, she only had to answer to herself and the Lord above, and she could tend to the needs of her own family instead of tending to every whim of the Talmadges. Ivy slipped out of the three-quarters bed and headed for the outhouse, careful not to wake Lewis. It was just 6 o'clock, but the sun was working its way up, and she knew the coolness of the dawn would give way to the heat of an Indian summer. As she returned to the house, Lewis was starting a fire in the wood stove that leaned precariously in the corner of the kitchen. She could hear Ella and Jake stirring in the room they shared. "Good morning, my Queen of Sheba," Lewis said, leaning down to give her a peck on the lips. "Looks like a perfect day to worship the Lord." Ivy smiled. Lewis said the same thing every Sunday. After breakfast, Lewis and Jake went outside to feed the chickens, while Ivy sent Ella to collect some Queen Anne's lace from the meadow along the creek below the cabin. As Ivy packed ham biscuits for lunch, she caught a glimpse of her husband and son through the cloudy window. At 15, Jake was getting tall like his father. he resembled him too, except that when Lewis was that where Lewis was solid muscle, Jake was skin and bones. She watched her son gently pick up each chicken to check its feet. Last year, one of the hens had come down with a bad case of bumblefoot, and Jake was determined to keep it from happening again. Ivy noticed Ella making her way back towards the cabin, her arms full of white blossoms. She had grown taller as well, but unlike her soft-spoken brother, Ella was lively, chattering all the time, and entertaining them with made-up stories and songs. She loved pulling through Miss Claire's fashion magazines, pointing out clothes, shoes, and pocketbooks she would buy if she had money to spend. When they were ready for church, Lewis helped Ivy into their rusty Ford truck. Jake and Ella sat on the makeshift bench in the truck's bed, the only way all four of them could ride together. As they passed the Craddock's cabin, they waved to Will, who was smoking on the porch. Lewis lit a cigarette and rested his elbows on the rim of the open window. Jake and Ella held tight to the edge of the wood slats as the truck bumped along the driveway and out into the main road. "Did you hear Herbert Allen's done left farming for good?" asked Lewis. "Every Sunday night, he drives a truck full of produce from around here all the way up to some market in Philadelphia. Then he goes to New York and buys used tires." "Used tires?" asked Abby. Lewis explained that up north, drivers replaced the tires on their vehicles long before the tread wore. "Down here, we drive till there ain't a lick of tread left. But up there, they put new ones on when the old ones are still good. Herbert buys the used ones for $1 a piece and brings them here to recap and sell." The truck hit another bump. "I sure do hope the road is driving out on is smoother than this one," Ivy said, "or he's going to be using all those recap tires for his own truck. I can't imagine making that trip. Ain't never been more than 20 miles out of Hobbsville." "Think he could give him some of our vegetables to take up there?" asked Ivy. "You know we got more tomatoes and peas than we can say grace over." Lewis shook his head. "Mr. Talmadge might not like it." Ivy clenched her hands around the family Bible. Why did they need Mr. Ivy's permission? He could hardly miss a few buckets of vegetables. Ivy glanced back again to make sure Jake and Ella hadn't bounced out of the truck.
Thank you, Leo. And that was Leo Daughtry reading from Talmadge Farm. So were any of the characters based on real people?
They were a composite of people. They are somebody I knew, maybe two people I knew and one person.
Okay. So, for example, I think Jake might have been sort of patterned after one of your childhood friends.
Yeah.
Yep.
And Bobby Lee went to the Army, went to 82nd Airborne and was shot up in Vietnam. He was one of my friends.
Now, you were in the military too, I understand.
That's right. I was in the Air Force.
And so that was before you went to law school?
No, it was. I got drafted after law school, and I went into, they gave you 30 days to enlist. And so I enlisted. I joined the Air Force instead of going into the Army. And I got to be a judge advocate general, and I was sent to Turkey and to sign the NATO.
You were JAG?
Yeah.
Do you ever watch that that TV show, JAG, years ago?
I never watched it.
I wonder how realistic it was. Wow. So why did you come back to the South after that, come back to North Carolina?
Well, I was a lawyer, and I planned to come back and to establish a law practice. That's what I did.
Wow. So when in your life did the idea for writing this book come
about
up?
About 10 years ago. Okay.
And did you start on it right away at that point?
I started making an outline 10 years ago. didn't have the nerve. I didn't have the nerve to start for a while.
What gave you the nerve to start?
I guess I met this. My daughter went to a school in went to Chapel Hill, and she had a sorority sister that was a very good writer. And I contacted her, she contacted me, and we would Zoom and start the process. We would start writing. I'd write, she'd write, we'd fight and talk and get a chapter we liked and start another one. It just went on for 3 years.
Now, helping you write yours, or she was writing her own and you were like?
She was helping me write mine. She was okay. The one who knew about the flowers and the book and things that I didn't know.
Okay. So in your acknowledgments, you have a big, you thank Lauren Stevens of Write Wisdom. Is that who we're talking about?
JJ, the next one.
J.J. Holzhauser. Okay, so you basically had a writing coach.
Had a writing partner.
A writing partner. Okay. All right.
So I would write, she would write. We liked some of mine, we liked some of hers.
So now she's not listed as a co-author, though.
No, and that I probably should have, but I didn't.
Mm. So, but you definitely acknowledge her.
I do.
Yeah. And so this went on for how many years?
Three or four.
And then you had a draft that you both felt really good about at that point.
Yep.
What was your next step?
Trying to find a publisher.
So how did you go about that?
That's where Lauren was very helpful. The one in the book. She helped me find book merchants. We talked with them and they agreed to publish it. And that took a long time to get that where we wanted it. And they added it even more. And we killed off one of my favorite people, Mary Grace's mother, Ruby. So it
Wow. Well, wait a minute. She wasn't dead in your original draft?
No, she was. She had rheumatic fever, and she had all these miscarriages.
Oh my gosh! Why'd they feel like you had to kill her off?
Too many characters, and
I can understand that. I can understand that. Okay, so. Story Merchant, I'm looking up Story Merchant Books, who's the publisher. So they're direct publishing of books. It says their goal is to discover dramatically or widely informative, exciting books and help them reach maximum audiences in all media. So what was the process of working with them like? You said they did a lot of editing.
Did editing, yeah. And they gave us advice about what to do and how to do it.
Did they do the cover design?
Yeah, they did. They helped me find someone to do the cover design.
Okay.
And I really like the cover. I think they did a great job.
Yeah. And it's interesting because, you know, they say you can't judge a book by a cover, but what else do we have to judge it by, you know, when you're going to pick it up in a store and, you know, in a bookshop. So the cover really matters.
I really was pleased with the cover. They found the person who did it, and it worked out great. And they had the book. It took a long time to get the book ready to publish. It's really slow.
Now, their website says that they promote the books to TV, movie, other media. Is that happening with Talmadge Farm?
Not yet, not that I know of.
Okay. Would you like to see this made into a movie?
Of course. I would love to see it made into a movie. I think it's a good story with good characters, and I think people would find it interesting to see on this big screen.
I do too. I could actually see this as a movie. I think it would work. Who would you have play Gordon?
What's the guy who played in Lonesome Dove? Who was that?
I am not sure, but I will look it up.
Ball-headed guy.
Okay, let's see who was in that. Oh, Tommy Lee Jones. Pardon?
The other guy.
The other guy. All right, there's Ricky Schroeder, Chris Cooper. Not sure which one. So
Tommy Jones, there was another guy.
There's been a couple of Lonesome Dove things, so I might be looking at the wrong one, but yeah. Of course, whoever it is has to be able to go from what about at the beginning of the book, he's what, in his 40s?
40s.
Yeah, and up to.
He's 45, and then he goes to guys, I guess, around 55.
Okay. 50. But at 55, because of his long years of smoking, he's an old man.
Yeah. And he also had so much stress on him, and he drank a lot.
Right. Smoking, drinking. He did not have a healthy lifestyle. Robert Duvall, is that who you're thinking?
Yeah, Robert Duvall.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
Who I wanted. Robert.
Yeah, yep. Yeah. And I don't know. He's a little old to play a 40-year-old though.
No, he couldn't now, but yeah. Somebody like him.
Yeah, someone like that. I can see him. I can see him. So, all right. So you've spent quite a few years working on this book, and it came out, when was it actually released?
June 4th.
Have you gotten any feedback from them, from readers?
Amazing. I've gotten great feedback. We sold about 500 books since June 4th.
Fantastic.
And we are optimistic, but I don't know exactly what to do now. I'm kind of waiting to see what happens.
Well, doing interviews like this helps.
It's so counting on you, Monica.
Yeah. All right. So when are you going to work on another book? Are you going to start another book?
I want to wait and see how this one does.
Okay.
We may do a prequel.
A prequel? Okay.
Yep.
I could see that. I can see that. So you'd would Gordon be the main character in that one as well?
You start with Gordon's great grandfather.
Okay. So yeah, that was interesting. The way that you don't go into much detail about it, but it is mentioned a few times that the family's money came from sapping pine trees.
Yeah.
That's Can you right. tell me a little bit about that?
Well, in the 1800s, England had the most dominant navy in the world. They were fighting the Spanish and the Portuguese. The Portuguese also had a very dominant navy. And the way the English were able to make ships was to use the sap out of longleaf pine. There's pitch, there's tar, and there's turpentine. And they would take this barrel of sap. They sent a bunch of Scotch Irish people to eastern North Carolina to start what they call naval stores. And these people would go out and they would cut these trees. They would slice a tree and take the sap out of it. Of course, that would kill the tree and put it in a barrel. Fill the barrel and put it in the river and ship it to Wilmington. And then they put it on a ship and send it to England. And in England, when it got to England, when they were making the boats, they would paint this turpentine substance on the side of the boat. And when a Spanish cannon hit the boat, it would just bounce off. And so they had this technique that came from North Carolina. And so they had all these naval stores. And they had the finest navy in the world. And it came from the longleaf pines in eastern North Carolina. So the Scotch people came down here. And my theory was that perhaps Gordon's great-grandfather went over to Fayetteville, where they had a slave market, and bought a 14-year-old woman and came back to his place. And that may be where Ivy's people came from.
So that's the story that you would write.
I'm thinking about it.
Yeah. Well, it's fascinating. So pine sap.
Pine tar. Call it pine tar.
Pine tar, yep. Being like the basis of wealth for these families. Was that the case with your family?
No.
No.
My family didn't have that.
Okay. So. Is this part of history well known in North Carolina?
I don't know how well known it is, but it is certainly part of our history.
Right.
And there were naval stores all over the East. They would take the barrels and put in the river and ship them down. And they finally figured out a way to make a raft and put them in the raft. The English needed these tars. They called them. That's how they got our name, Tar Heel.
Oh, okay. That makes sense. Wow. Now, what about cotton? Was cotton grown in that area too?
Cotton was the king in the early 1900s. Tobacco was just beginning to get accepted. Most of the tobacco at that time was chewed or snuff that the women dipped. And cotton was king, but then the boll weevil came along, and cotton prices would go up and down, and it was not a way for people to make a living. It just wasn't. So the tobacco sort took cotton out of the picture. But they would all grow cotton, but it was not their way to survive.
So what is agriculture like in that area of North Carolina now?
It's big business. We have a lot of, just like Iowa, we have a lot of livestock. We grow tobacco, we grow cotton. In some areas, they grow produce like pepper, cucumber, squash, tomatoes. So we do have a very vibrant agricultural economy, but not like it used to be. It's not all we have.
And are migrant workers kind of the backbone of the agriculture labor now, today?
Yep.
And but are they treated better than the migrant workers were in this time?
Much better. They have a program, and the migrants come, and they have a place to stay, and they work under good conditions. They are paid very well, and when the season's over, they go back to Mexico.
Wow. One of the things that you wrote about was the overseer of the migrant or the contractor who brought the migrant workers up wouldn't even let them have water out in the fields on hot days. And it just seemed barbaric.
It was a crew leader in those days. He got these people off the streets in Florida, off of Miami and other towns that were either alcoholics or mentally disturbed, and put them in a bus. And when they woke up, they were in Charleston, South Carolina, in a cotton field.
Wow.
Or somewhere else.
Wow. So Gordon Talmadge, who's, like I said, the kind of the patriarch of the family, the banker, the one resistant to change, he's really not a very nice guy, but he does change. And tell me how you sort of, how you make that change believable, and do you think it's, you know, did men like him change?
I think so. I think he had so many disappointments. He lost his farm. He lost the bank. He watched his wife, and she became, I don't know where you could say she was tired of him, but life wasn't good for her. He began to recognize that. His boy, Junior, who he wanted to be like him, was a disappointment. He was an alcoholic. He killed a girl in a car, or damaged, hurt a girl really badly in a car. And David, on the other hand, was like his mother. And I think over a period of time, Gordon began to realize that he had made some bad mistakes, and that being unfriendly to his sharecroppers was one of them, because here they were. Mary Grace was actually saving him. She was finding him when he was sick, when he got drunk. She tried to figure out a way to help him out with his hangover. So these people became a part of his life, and he sort of depended on them.
And so it was really recognizing the humanity of individuals that changed maybe his attitudes in general. Yeah. So I think sometimes now there you do see, or I have seen cases though, where people will, you know, they might embrace a family member or someone that they're close to who is, you know, different, you know, other color, other class, other, you know, LGBTQ or something, and yet they still have the prejudice against the group as a whole.
I think so. I think that's still true today.
Yeah.
You can meet someone you really like a lot, but at the same time, you don't change your attitude. I really think it's true even today.
Yeah, I think it is too.
Not as much.
And at least it gives an opening, maybe. It's a little, the attitude might have been 100%, and now maybe that prejudice is only 90%, and maybe they meet somebody else and the prejudice goes down to 80%. You know, it's one-on-one is a way to change the world eventually. So let's go back to talk about your writing process. Were you writing on computer?
No. I can hardly work. I'm so old. I can't think about it. My passport always escapes me, and so I write on.
So you write on paper. So when you were doing this with your writing partner, how were you exchanging chapters?
I would send it to him, and I had someone in the office who could email it to him.
Okay, so somebody else would type it in.
Yeah, or they could just send a page.
Or they scan it. They'd scan it in and email it to her. Yeah, nowadays we have scanners. It is a lot easier. But at some point it got typed in, obviously.
Of course, it would get typed.
Yeah, and when you were editing, were you using a typed version then to edit?
Yeah.
But you'd mark your edits in pen on the printouts. Okay.
Lots of.
How many versions do you think you had?
I would say 6 or 8. I don't know.
Wow. What will you do differently if you do write another book?
I don't know. I just don't know.
Or the process works, that this process works for you.
I've got to have an outline. I can't do it without.
Yeah.
Where I'm going to be. And I've got to figure it out. I've got to marry beginning of the book with Gordon and his family, but somehow I got to get to them.
Mm. So if somebody else, you know, the thing that I like about this is that you're kind of taking, you know, it's a historical novel, but it's really, the focus is on the people and the events that are happening around them really and really affect their lives. And I think you did a wonderful job with that. And with keeping the focus on the characters, and with making the character, you know, the villain of the story really is Gordon, but he does, you can hate him, but you also feel sorry for him.
Yeah, because he was so entrenched in a way of life that maybe was there when he first started. And he was a young guy when his dad died. He wasn't very smart.
Yeah.
He was not a smart guy. He was more an athlete. I saw people when I was in school that were big and strong and dumb. And I sort of thought Gordon may be like that.
Yeah. And sometimes they can skate by their entire lives without ever being kind of found out as lacking.
Bully, kind of a bully.
Yeah. Yeah. Wasn't really thinking about anyone but himself. But until he did. Until eventually he did.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Leo, I want to thank you for being with us today. I really enjoyed reading Talmadge Farm.
Thank you so much for having me. And I hope you have a great weekend.
You too. And we always close with the quote, so I'm going to read the one from the beginning of your book from Daniel Webster. Let us not forget that the cultivation of the earth is the most important labor of man. When tillage begins, other arts will follow. The farmers, therefore, are the founders of civilization. Thank you. And see you all next week on Writers' Voices.
Bye-bye.